Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. In this time of the COVID-19 pandemic, people from all over our community are stepping up to help. That's true as well at the University of New Mexico. On this episode, I speak with researchers in the Department of Molecular Genetics and Microbiology who are working on a vaccine for the coronavirus. But first, we'll hear how faculty and students are working to boost the supply of personal protective equipment to hospitals and the community. Christina Salas is Assistant Professor of Engineering in the Department of Orthopedics at the UNM Health Sciences Center. Heather Canavan is a professor in the Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering and is also with the Biomedical Engineering Graduate Program. Christine, you are coordinating these efforts. Can you talk a little bit about what you and other faculty are doing to create personal protective equipment?
Our largest effort right now is a School of Engineering effort in collaboration with the School of Medicine in order to 3D print personal protective equipment, particularly face masks and face shields. We have two efforts running kind of in parallel, the one at a UNM research facility. Heather's primarily focused on the face shields, and this other facility, this other UNM research facility is focused on the face masks. What we'd like to do is to use these 3D printers that we've acquired. They're high-end 3D printers that are capable of printing materials that are soft and comfortable for our providers to be able to wear for long days, long-term. But they have replaceable cartridges that can be put on them that have the filtration that's required in order to protect against any virus particles that they may be exposed to.
So are these the N95 masks?
So right now, we're not making N95-specific masks. We're focusing specifically on what are considered procedure masks. So they're kind of the first step in the development of masks. And we're simultaneously going to be conducting some tests in order to further improve the masks to increase the filtration efficiency of them. So the greater the filtration capability, the higher they can be rated for use in our hospitals and in any of our healthcare systems.
And so you're using 3D printers to make these.
That is correct. What we're printing is a flexible polyurethane type material that can actually contour better to the face and will provide a nice seal around the healthcare provider's face so that not just the filters are doing their work in capturing particles, but we can ensure that there's no particles entering from anywhere else on the mask.
Have you already delivered some of these?
We have not yet delivered any. So we actually just started the large scale effort on this. It hasn't been more than about 4 days now, actually, we started production. And so we are actually working at a point where we can produce about 500 to 700 masks a week. But we're also working in collaboration with the UNM Health Science Center to run simultaneous testing on these first masks that we're producing, just to make sure that we are meeting the standards that have been set forth by the hospital so that our healthcare providers can feel comfortable wearing the masks that we're producing and know that they will be provided the same level of protection as some of the standard masks that they're typically acquiring.
Is the plan that these go to mostly UNM hospitals or will they go to other places as well?
Well, not necessarily. So we're actually working with the governor's office to determine where the needs are in the state of New Mexico. So, of course, the UNM Health Science Center will receive a portion of the masks that we fabricate, but our intention is to be able to distribute this statewide. And so we're currently in discussion with the governor's staff in order to determine where those needs are right now. And so as soon as we understand what those needs are, we'll be working to ship these out as soon as we can.
So when do you anticipate delivering the masks to folks that you're working on now?
Yeah, so we anticipate delivering masks as early as this week, by the end of the week. They will be tiered depending on the level of testing that's been completed at that time and what are the requirements or the requests that are being made and what their standards are. So, you know, we have a number of people that are in communities outside of Albuquerque that, you know, might be wearing bandanas or just kind of anything that they can get on their face right now. And so we expect to be able to deliver the products that we have right now, which are considered, like I said, equivalent to procedure type masks. These are things that a first responder might wear or even a physician might wear in a clinic or an emergency room setting. And so we feel comfortable that the masks are ready at that point. And so we will be distributing those. And as we continue to improve the design through testing, then we can go to places like, you know, UNM Hospital. We've had people reach out from Loveless Presbyterian, other places, looking for these kind of higher quality N95 equivalent masks. And so we'll be working in parallel to conduct this testing to ensure that we can meet those standards as well. So we expect to not only provide better quality masks, but also increase production as we improve the design of the masks. So we'll be buying additional printers and working with other smaller medical manufacturing groups in Albuquerque to improve not only performance of the masks, but efficiency in getting them out to the people who need them.
What kinds of other projects are you planning under this partnership? Do you know yet?
There are a number of faculty members within the School of Engineering who are working on the development of portable ventilators. What we're trying to do is take some guidance from the CDC and the FDA. We don't, ventilators are highly regulated devices. There are kind of expedited processes that are being set in place in order to take equipment to modify them so that they serve as ventilators. And so that's what a couple of our faculty members are working on right now in order to see if we can meet those FDA requirements so that they can be used in our hospital setting. There has been some word that nasal swabs are in need as well. And so fortunately, because the material that we're using is a nice, like flexible plastic material, it's actually soft enough for you to be able to use as a nasal swab. And so we have a subset of the group looking at basically fabrication of nasal swabs in the event that our healthcare providers are in need of those. We also have other faculty members in the School of Engineering who are helping to make hand sanitizer. We have some that are from our computer science and electrical engineering departments that are looking at models to understand spread of COVID. And so there's other research being done outside of the 3D printing area within the School of Engineering. And so we're just hoping to continue to expand each of those, to continue to acquire funding in order to support each of those projects. You know, the best way to help us help support that is through our UNM Foundation and support of our students.
This is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. I'm speaking with Christina Solis, Assistant Professor of Engineering in the Department of Orthopedics at the Health Sciences Center, and Professor Heather Canavan from the Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering at UNM about how they're coordinating efforts to help boost supplies during the coronavirus pandemic. I want to turn to you, Heather. You have moved your lab operations into your garage. What are you and your team doing?
You know, originally we went on extended spring break, and then it was, we're not going to allow undergrads and graduate students into the labs for the rest of the semester and so forth. And so I brought home my 3D printers, all my gloves and all of that kind of stuff. And what I was thinking was there has to be something that's kind of a quick and dirty response. And that's something that I think that we could really help with. And so I started brainstorming with my group, what are some things that we could do? And it started off with the simple FDA approved things like face shields that we can make, and also fabric masks and hand sanitizer and delivery of those items. In addition, there have been a lot of people on Nextdoor and other social media apps that are, you know, talented sewers who are trying to contribute. They're having a hard time getting things like the elastic to make face masks. And so I just thought, well, that's something that we can help with, is putting together kits to speed up the people that are sewing, and then the distribution, because it's all well and good to encourage social distancing. But if then every person is going and getting the stuff from the store, making it at their house, and then going to the hospital, then they're elevating their own risk. And so I thought, well, this is a way of having one person that's going from place to place and picking them up, limiting everybody else's risk. And then I have stuff in my garage, like an autoclave that I bought, that I can sterilize the masks we make and so forth. When I was talking it over with my students, I was saying it's more like a distributed system, like a Grubhub, but for scrubs. And so we started calling it Scrubhub, ABQ.
So how are you guys getting this out to people? You're putting all these materials together and then you or your students are going out and delivering, or how is this working?
My house is the hub of Scrub Hub. So stuff is getting dropped off from neighbors. Anyone who has extra fabric has been dropping it off on my patio. And then in my garage, there are two 3D printers and so forth. And then volunteers are taking the materials out to the people who are creating the fabric masks and so forth, and then bringing them back. And the reason I did that is because in addition to the concern of the health concern of flattening the curve, there's also an economic problem that we're facing, which is, you know, the tens of thousands of people that became unemployed overnight. And a lot of them are people that don't have a lot of cushion. They are waiters and waitresses. And we know that from previous epidemiological events that the more people have financial insecurity, the riskier the decisions they have to make to stay afloat. If I can distribute things through students, kind of like, you know, a Deliveroo or a Grubhub kind of employee, then I'm not only reducing the risk, but potentially I can pay those people with a stipend that allows them to have some money so that they are financially stable. And so the idea is, you know, for 4 hours a shift, they get a $50 stipend, which is approximately minimum wage. And then they can do two shifts a week, and that is below what would be counted as a income. So it's not risking their unemployment. This is Scrubhub ABQ, but I can imagine there being Scrubhub Taos, Scrubhub Seattle, Washington, you know, whatever. And using that kind of mechanism to pay people so that they have some funding while they wait for unemployment to kick in, while they wait for another, you know, for a check from the federal government and so forth, is a way to provide a little bit more stability.
How many folks are you paying stipends to do this?
Right now I've got 12 people, but right before I came on the air with you, there were three more people who said that they would join up. Although the vast majority have said that they want to join, but they don't need to get paid, which is amazing because that means that I have more funding that I can give to those people who need it. So that's really great. What I've been calling them is the scrubberoos. Mm-hmm. So the majority of the scrubberoos are doing things like piecing the material.
And who's getting the finished products?
I'm teaching a class called Adaptive Design right now. And we brainstormed with the students who are the people who are in the most need, who are the least likely to be able to get their own personal protective equipment. And let's start with them. So for example, people in nursing homes we know are especially vulnerable from looking at what's happened in Seattle and New York. So, you know, we can drop them off with them. Then there's also a lot of home healthcare workers who don't have any kind of personal protection, but their clients are also at risk. Okay, we can donate to them. Christina and I both work between kind of our research spans, both the School of Engineering and the School of Medicine. We know a lot of people who work in those areas. And so we can personally give them to those people if that's something that they need. So that's kind of how we've been starting off. I know that there are other groups who have a really great distribution list, and we'll definitely fill in wherever we can. One of the benefits of having students who have cars and are looking forward to getting paid is that this means that potentially we can start driving them elsewhere to places that don't have enough supplies.
I forgot to mention, you brought up Broken Trails Distillery, and you are partnering with them, right?
Yeah. So the reason that distilleries across the U.S. are ramping up to do this kind of operation is because, you know, they can convert from making whiskey and vodka and so forth to making really high purity hand sanitizer. So I just drove over there and introduced myself to one of the drivers, and I said, hey, I want to help you out. What can I do? You know, one of the things that they said was they needed more containers and little containers that they could give out and big containers they could give out. And I was like, I run a chemistry lab. I have nothing but containers. You know, the scrubberoos are going to start delivering hand sanitizer as well, because that is such a high quality, high purity material that they're making. And then they don't have to worry about making their own.
And how are you both funding these efforts?
You're seeing that we're on two ends of the spectrum, and that's because we're trying to solve different problems that are related. And so what Christina has been able to do is find funding at, you know, large levels of funding from the federal government, which is important for this type of building a new facility and the novel stuff that she's doing. And for me, it was just, you know, I kind of went rogue by taking all my stuff home. And I thought, well, since that's the case, I will hit up first my friends and family and everybody on LinkedIn and Facebook and social media and so forth. But one of the things I did do was I had a student enter the student pitch competition from the Albuquerque's Pitch-In. And he won that competition called the Pitch-In competition. And so that'll be a big shot in the arm, because up till now, like I said, it was like, you know, $25, $50 on GoFundMe and so forth. And this is going to be $7,500. So quite a bit.
Thank you both so much for your efforts in this strange times we live in.
It's nice to talk about this. I think that, you know, Christina and I are, like she said, we're part of a bunch of people that are trying to contribute. And it's something that is, in my opinion, a really great way to give back. The people of New Mexico have supported us. You know, we've got great jobs at the university and we have a lot of stability. And we're trying to help the rest of our population who maybe doesn't have that safety net. And everything that you're doing to help talk to those people and let them know that we can help them is a really big thing for me.
Yes, thank you so much.
You're listening to University Showcase, and that was Professor Heather Canavan from the Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering at UNM, and Assistant Professor of Engineering Christina Solis, who's in the Department of Orthopedics at the Health Sciences Center. Find links to their projects and photos at KUNM.org. Faculty are also engaged in the race to find a vaccine for COVID-19. I spoke with Professors Bryce Chakarian and David Peabody, both of whom are in the Department of Molecular Genetics and Microbiology at the UNM School of Medicine.
Dave's lab has been working on an effort using this platform technology, but there are other labs here that are working on other components of coronavirus. So, for example, Stephen Bradfute, who's an infectious disease researcher here, has the virus here at UNM and has established an infection model in cells. And the value of that is that he can use that model to test not only the sera that we generate from some of our vaccines, but also test the ability of antibodies to block coronavirus infection, various drugs to block coronavirus infection. And the hope is that in the next few months, we'll also have animal models that will allow us to test whether some of these different prophylactic or therapeutic interventions can also work in animals.
And when you say you're using a platform technology, what does that mean, David?
This whole thing is based on viruses of bacteria, so-called RNA bacteriophages. Particularly, one that we use the most is a virus called MS2. And the basic sort of architecture of viruses is similar. It falls into a few basic categories across all of biology. But in effect, what we do, we take bits and pieces of the structure of the coronavirus and decorate the outside of our MS2 virus-like particle, this harmless particle, with bits and pieces from the structure of SARS-CoV-2. And so this entirely harmless particle then, in effect, masquerades as a coronavirus in a sense, so that when introduced into an animal or a human, the hope is that it will trick the host into thinking that it's been infected with SARS-CoV-2 and mount a response that neutralizes the virus. So it's a platform technology in the sense that we can decorate it with what we call epitopes, or as I say, bits and pieces of the structure of other viruses or a variety of other substances, not just viruses, but bacteria and even some self-antigens, and elicit strong and very long-lasting antibody responses basically to any target that we choose. That's the idea.
And how does your work, you're working with Stephen, is it Bradfute, Is that his last
name? Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So how does what he's doing intersect with what you're doing? How do you work together?
Okay, so we construct these virus-like particles and then immunize animals with them. We immunize mice as a way of testing whether or not we can provoke an antibody response that neutralizes the virus, in this case, the SARS-CoV-2. And of course, to know for sure that it works, we have to have someone who's actually cultivating that virus who can test the sera that we derive from these mice for the ability to neutralize that authentic infection by the coronavirus itself. Without that kind of a neutralization test, we have no way really of assessing the efficacy of our approach.
Are you to the point where you have actually tested in mice?
We have some vaccine candidates in mice now for a little over 2 weeks.
How long does it take to gauge whether there is some kind of reaction?
Bryce can tell you more about the immunology of it, but I think typically about 3 weeks after immunization, they reach the peak of the response, and then we harvest serum from the animals and test it for its ability to neutralize the coronavirus itself.
Where are you with that, Bryce?
Yeah, so as Dave mentioned, this went into mice about 2.5 weeks ago. So I think the idea is to collect some serum from the animals this week. And then there are a number of assays that we can do to test whether the antibodies that the animals are making are going to be effective against the coronavirus. And then we can collaborate with Steven's lab to test whether the sera actually can block coronavirus infection. We obviously are testing a number of vaccine candidates. We don't know which ones are going to work. One of the advantages of this platform technology is that we can induce really strong immune responses. We have some data from other vaccines that we can get very effective immune responses after a single immunization. So I think that's the hope. And then, you know, Dave also is making a number of other vaccine candidates. We're selecting small parts of the coronavirus that we're displaying on our vaccine platform. And there's some uncertainty about, you know, what is the right part of the virus to choose. That's a reason to test a number of different vaccine candidates. But I think, you know, one of the advantages of our platform, again, is that it's remarkably fast going from an idea to an actual vaccine candidate. And so, you know, that allows us to test a number of different permutations of the system. The slow thing is the animal work. You know, that's the thing that takes weeks. But unfortunately, that's an essential part of testing whether these vaccines are effective or not.
You're looking at how you could attack different parts of the virus. It's not just one part that, you know, like silver bullet, that's it.
The virus itself, of course, is a complex structure. Everybody by now has seen these images on television. Usually in red for some reason, I don't know why, that showed this roughly spherical particle with these spikes projecting off of it. And virtually the entire surface of that virus particle has the capacity or may have the capacity to elicit antibodies to it. Of course, the human antibody response is very diverse, and it will recognize and attack all of these structures, or many of these structures presented on the surface of, in this case, the coronavirus. Some of those antibodies may not be effective at neutralizing the virus. They may attack parts of the virus that are essentially irrelevant to its function. Others attack very specific structures, particularly in the case of coronavirus, on the so-called spike protein, those projections that you see from the virus particle in the images. The spike protein is responsible for binding the receptor on the cell surface that the virus uses for entry into the cell. And antibodies that bind that spike protein then can interfere with binding with the cell and inhibit entry. And that's largely what we're targeting. So we're trying to go just specifically for those little bits that are essential for mediating binding of the virus to the cell and subsequently its entry into the cell. If we can inhibit that binding, we ought to be able to prevent infection.
Since no one had really seen this virus before, we keep learning more about it all the time. How is that impacting what you're doing day to day?
It's important to mention that that this is informed by prior work on the virus that I guess some of us now are calling SARS-CoV-1 from the 2002-2003 outbreak. It turns out that this virus is quite similar to that one, and we know quite a lot about the human immune response to that virus.
According to the World Health Organization, there are over 100 vaccine candidates right now. How does this work? How are you coordinating, or are you coordinating with other vaccine researchers around the world?
I think the hope is with coronavirus that this might actually be a fairly easy virus to develop a vaccine for. And so I think right now we're still in that stage where we want to explore as many different vaccine strategies as possible. You've probably heard in the news about, you know, a couple of different vaccine candidates that have already moved into people. Those strategies are ones that are fairly easy to develop, but as of yet, they're probably less immunogenic than other sorts of strategies. So again, it's unclear whether those vaccines that are easy to develop but maybe don't induce as strong immune responses are going to be effective or not. And so right now, the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, has been very supportive of trying to develop as many different strategies as possible for potential vaccines. I think that's sort of where we are. There are vaccine candidates from universities, from companies that are all moving into towards clinical trials. And, you know, we're not that close yet. We need to get some good data from these initial experiments, but hopefully that would be what would happen with our vaccine as well.
I mean, there's the question of controlling this pandemic, right? But there's also the question of dealing with the next one. We think that our platform has the potential to be as rapid a response as is possible. Of course, the bottleneck in the end always is clinical testing, right? The clinical trials will always be the limitation on how rapidly a vaccine can be developed.
I mean, you have no idea if any of this is going to work, but what does it feel like to at least be working on this?
So initially, my feeling was, don't go chasing after this, that lots and lots of people are doing this. But at some point, it just felt like we have to do something. I mean, this is what we do, you know. Part of it maybe is just the sense that wanting to take control of the situation a little bit in this time of such huge uncertainty, to feel like you're actually trying at least to do something about it.
And I don't think we're unique in that way. You know, I think there are other researchers here at UNM who are trying to contribute in their own ways. We have, and I have to say that, you know, the other thing that I think is heartening is how the whole scientific community has really mobilized to try to target this virus in terms of the sorts of materials that we need to, for example, test our vaccine. It's amazing how quickly those became available to the entire scientific community. People developed these things, they contributed them to reagent sharing services so that they can get distributed across the country and around the world. That's how Stephen, for example, was able to get the virus so quickly. How we're getting a source of the spike protein that we're using for various reasons in these experiments. So I think all those things have been really, really heartening about how that this has galvanized the scientific community to go after you know, one target.
I've been speaking with professors Bryce Chakarian and David Peabody, both of whom are in the Department of Molecular Genetics and Microbiology at the UNM School of Medicine. And thanks to my other guests, Professor Heather Canavan from the Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering at UNM, and Assistant Professor of Engineering Christina Salas, who's in the Department of Orthopedics at the Health Sciences Center. Find links to their work at KUNM.org, where you can find all our previous episodes as well. And thanks to Associate Professor David Bashwinner for our theme music. I'm Megan Kamrick. This is University Showcase.